burn calories.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the June 28th reading of The Environment, a compilation of articles from the Nature Conservancy magazine, the Sierra Club magazine, and Mother Earth News magazine. My name is John. We'll read the following main articles this afternoon. The Tale of the Coyote-Proof Chihuahua Suit, written by Kim Hulo. From Mother Earth News, we'll also read What Herbs Are Good for Arthritis, written by James A. Duke, Ph.D., and with any remaining time, we'll fill in with some miscellaneous articles. So let's get started. The Tale of the Coyote-Proof Chihuahua Suit. TikTok told us to buy studded armor for our tiny dog. We called her Poppy Seed for her mottled fur, which is black, and because when she came to live with us in Brooklyn, she weighed in at 2 pounds flat. We were told by the shelter that she had been found out in the wild, abandoned in a field in rural Texas, a fact that we recited to her whenever she resisted our attempts to coax her outside. To potty, we would carry her to her favorite patch of sidewalk grass, and she would walk only when she was convinced that we were heading home. We joked that she must have been the product of natural selection, solely calibrated to domestic environments where the temperature was controlled, the predators were non-existent, and the kibble was engineered to be easily digestible. Perhaps my phone had heard this, and the fact that we were planning to visit my partner's family in Lake Tahoe. Before our departure, TikTok delivered to me a clip of a chihuahua in spike-studded armor. Please beware, went the audio, if you have small dogs in California. We were advised to purchase a coyote suit at $109.95 pre-tax. I showed the video to my partner, who joked that poppy seed would make the perfect snack for a coyote. We thought about hawks and foxes. We looked up headlines on bobcat strikes. I had a grim premonition that we had bestowed upon Poppy Seed a name that portended her edibility. She trembled when faced with a floating plastic bag. How did we expect her to fare out in nature? Strapped on top of her fleece onesie, the coyote suit lent Poppy Seed a certain punk metal chic that at once calmed my anxiety and stoked my affection. Though my partner's family in Tahoe found it absolutely ridiculous, and perhaps a reflection of our equally ridiculous choice to live in the city. To be fair, I could hardly imagine them living in Brooklyn, where life seemed to occur on a different scale, crammed into apartments with awkward angles and sardine tin subway cars. They each stood at 6 feet, with huge hands and robust beards, and spent their days on the mountain, the lake, or the trail. I thought about this all the while walking Poppy in her coyote suit one evening in Tahoe, down an empty, snow-lined drive. After resisting both the change of scenery and the change of attire, she had progressed by the third day from petrification to a curious, if careful, trot. When she stopped to press her snout into a patch of exposed earth, I raised my face to the purpling sky, which was now framed by the silhouette of jagged pines. I took in a lungful of air, cold and resinous, then settled into the cavernous silence, a pocket of stillness shattered by nearby rustle, from which I instinctively turned, scooped up poppy seed, and ran. Upon our return, I expressed to my partner's family what I thought was an unfortunate trade-off. The stars out there were so beautiful, I said, but I hated the idea that no one might hear you if you screamed. This elicited confused indignation, particularly from the cousin who had just returned from a months-long solo stint backcountry skiing. The cousins were as baffling to me as they were enviable. I, too, wanted to feel so inseparable from nature that any indictment against it felt personal. Although I'd grown up in a city, I'd never thought of myself as chronically urban. In Sydney, Australia, you aren't ever too far from the beach or the bush, and I'd even gone camping in a tent through a high school program. But in these moments, I felt like a different species to these cousins altogether. Nevertheless, I resolved for the remainder of the trip to be into nature. I rose with the sun. I consulted mountain maps. I attempted to ski. Whenever I found myself face to face with the snow, which was often, I tried to find something redeeming about the opportunity to encounter nature so closely. Yet all I found was that I newly identified with my chihuahua in her coyote suit. I felt like a different creature intended for a different habitat, the kind with flowers that bloom year-round under the awnings of bodegas. Back in Brooklyn, I stowed the coyote suit away and went out for groceries. As I closed the door of our apartment behind me, I saw Poppy Seed curl into herself contentedly on the blanket-strewn couch. Outside, the air was warmer than I had anticipated, which made me realize that it hadn't yet snowed all winter. The building across from ours had been vacated suddenly due to a rat infestation. The front yard had been thoroughly burrowed into a choppy sea of soil. I put on my mask to enter the grocery store, where I discovered that egg prices were up, apparently because of avian flu. It had been a strangely optimistic illusion to assume that the lives of the Tahoe cousins were embedded so thoroughly in nature while mine stood apart from it. To think that nature, even in the city, might be contained by boxes and fences and prepackaged arrangements for purchase seemed increasingly like a self-protective myth. Later in bed, scrolling through Twitter, I saw a meteorologist confirm that New York City temperatures in January had been above average all 31 days of the month. Perhaps I had failed at my quest to be into nature, but that did not mean there was any way out of it. No matter where we lived, we were at home with nature. No matter what kind of creature we were fundamentally inseparable from it. Kim Hugh Lowe is an Australian writer living in Brooklyn and an assistant editor at The Believer. Our next reading this afternoon for the environment comes to us from Mother Earth News. What herbs are good for arthritis? Written by James A. Duke, Ph.D. Wondering what herbs are good for our arthritis? James Duke, Ph.D., explains how to make and use home remedies for arthritis in hands and other parts of the body. Back in the good old days, I played bass fiddle in a 5-member band. At that time, 3 of our band members or their relatives were using an herb known as stinging nettle to relieve arthritis pain. Although stinging nettle does cook up into a tasty vegetable, these musicians were not eating it. Rather, they were stinging themselves with it by grasping the plant in a gloved hand and then swatting their stiff and swollen joints. This practice, called urtication, from nettle's botanical name, Urtica dioica, dates back at least 2,000 years. Although it's an odd-sounding practice, there's no escaping the fact that it's been around so long precisely because it helps so many people. Our banjo player kept a plant in his kitchen so he could self-urticate when his arthritis flared up. The guitar player's mother-in-law was unable to write because of arthritis in her hands, but the sting of the nettle improved that. The fiddle player's mother soon had stinging nettle taking over her garden and said her arthritis was much improved. My former secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, kept a nettle plant in the office. She would use the nettle to discreetly sting herself when arthritis stiffened her fingers. On a before and after photocopied image of her hand, you could see how the swelling went down. Urtication often provides considerable relief, sometimes very quickly. I've seen arthritic swelling subside within minutes after the stings were administered. The case for stinging nettle. I'm open to the notion that stinging nettle's anti-arthritis action is based on distraction, meaning the irritation of the sting simply takes people's minds off their arthritis pain. That's an explanation you might hear from medical doctors, but as a botanist, I think what's going on is more chemical than psychological. The tiny stingers of the nettle plant provide micro-injections of several chemicals responsible for the stinging sensation the plant causes. One doctor told me many of these chemicals might also trigger anti-inflammation action that would help relieve arthritis. The sting injects a histaminic substance, and the body mounts an antihistaminic reaction, some of which goes to the sting, some to the other inflammation. On every continent where it grows, stinging nettle has developed a reputation as a treatment for arthritis. I don't think that's a coincidence. If you'd like to give urtication a try, you shouldn't have much problem locating a plant. It's a common weed throughout most of the United States. If you're not sure how to identify it, someone who works at a plant nursery or your local county agricultural extension agent should be able to help out. Osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. Arthritis literally means joint inflammation. According to the Arthritis Foundation, there are more than 100 different diseases that produce joint pain and inflammation. Everything from the flu to certain cancers. But when people say arthritis, they usually mean osteoarthritis. Also known as degenerative joint disease, osteoarthritis is the most prevalent of more than a dozen different kinds of arthritis. Some 16 million Americans have it. The hips, knees, spine, and tiny joints of the hands and feet are most frequently affected. Osteoarthritis usually develops gradually, beginning with minor aches that eventually lead to extended pain, stiffness, swelling, and limited range of motion. Symptoms sometimes, but not always, subside with gentle physical activity. Rheumatoid arthritis, another form of arthritis, has a nasty reputation because it can cause crippling joint deformity. But many of the 2.1 million Americans with RA, rheumatoid arthritis, approximately 75% of whom are women, have milder, non-crippling cases that flare up and subside mysteriously. Frequently, both hands are affected, but rheumatoid arthritis can strike other joints as well. In addition to joint pain, swelling, and warmth, possible symptoms include fatigue, fever, loss of appetite, enlarged lymph nodes, lumps under the skin, and muscle stiffness after sleep or inactivity. Stiffness usually subsides with moderate activity. Green pharmacy. What herbs are good for arthritis? Along with stinging nettle, there are a number of other natural remedies for arthritis pain that can help out. Ginger and turmeric. I consider these the herbal alternatives to the new drugs Celebrex and Vioxx. In one study, researchers gave 3 to 7 grams of ginger a day to 18 people with osteoarthritis and 28 with rheumatoid arthritis. More than 75% of those participating in this study reported at least some relief from pain and swelling. Even after more than 2 years of taking these high doses of ginger, none of the people reported any side effects. Turmeric contains close chemical relatives of compounds found in ginger, so I'm not surprised this herb also has a major reputation as an arthritis treatment. You can enjoy both herbs in a wide variety of spicy dishes, as well as using them for teas. Pineapple. Some intriguing research suggests bromelain, a chemical in pineapple, helps prevent inflammation. For some time now, athletic trainers have been recommending pineapple to athletes to prevent and treat sports injuries. It's also a good bet for people with arthritis. Bromelain can help the body get rid of immune antigen complex, compounds that are implicated in some arthritis conditions. It also helps digest fibrin, another compound suspected of being involved in some types of arthritis. If you need an excuse to indulge yourself with fresh, ripe pineapple, this is it. Red pepper. Red pepper causes some pain on the tongue, but ironically interferes with pain perception elsewhere in the body. The pain-relieving chemical in red pepper, capsaicin, triggers the body to release endorphins, nature's own opiates. Red pepper also contains aspirin-like compounds known as salicylates. You can make a tea by mixing red pepper into water. But it would be a whole lot more pleasurable to have your red pepper cooked in a variety of spicy dishes. For a quick hit, try a splash of hot pepper sauce and tomato juice. Just biting into a hot pepper releases some of your own painkillers into your body. Compounds in red pepper can also help relieve arthritis when you apply the herb to the skin. Researchers have discovered you'll get significant pain relief if you apply capsaicin cream directly to painful arthritic joints 4 times daily. In one study of this treatment, the capsaicin cream reduced rheumatoid arthritis pain by more than half. Osteoarthritis pain was reduced by about 1/3. Look for capsaicin in the ingredient list of over-the-counter pain creams, such as Zostrix and Capsaicin P, or ask your doctor for a prescription capsaicin product. If you use capsaicin cream, be sure to wash your hands thoroughly afterwards. You do not want to get it in your eyes or other tender places. Some people are quite sensitive to this compound, so test it on a small area of skin to make sure that it's okay for you to use. If it irritates your skin, do not use it. Stinging nettle. Beyond stinging painful joints, there's another method of using this herb to treat arthritis: steaming the fresh leaves and enjoying them as a vegetable. Although you have to wear gloves to harvest the leaves, they lose their sting when cooked. The Rheumatoid Disease Foundation suggests that 3 milligrams of boron daily may be helpful in treating both osteo and rheumatoid arthritis. An analysis of stinging nettle provided by USDA scientists shows this herb contains 47 parts per million of the mineral boron, figured on a dry weight basis. That means a 100-gram serving of stinging nettle, easily prepared by steaming several ounces of young, tender leaves, could contain more than the recommended amount of boron. According to the Rheumatoid Disease Foundation, boron is effective because it plays a role in helping bones retain calcium. It also has beneficial influence on the body's hormonal system, and hormones play a role in helping the body maintain healthy bones and joints. Celery seed. Since I wrote The Green Pharmacy several years ago, I have not had a single attack of gout, one especially painful type of arthritis. I started taking celery seed when I read it helps lower levels of uric acid, the gout culprit. There are nearly 24 anti-inflammatory compounds in celery, including one very important miracle aspirin called apigenin. I now enjoy curried celery when I'm not on the road, celery seed extracts when I am. And celery, or serendipity, has prevented my gout for more than 6 years now. Knock on my wooden leg. Brazil nut and sunflower. SAM, S-A-M, is shorthand for S-adenosylmethionine, a chemical shown to have pain-relieving and anti-inflammatory properties similar to those found in the over-the-counter medication ibuprofen. SAM can be found in high methionine seeds and Brazil nuts. It would take 250 grams of sunflower seeds, about 9 ounces, or 500 grams of Brazil nuts, about 18 ounces, to provide a dose of SAM that's more effective than a standard dose of ibuprofen. It's not feasible to eat that many nuts and seeds, but every little bit helps, especially if you use the other natural approaches this article recommends. Go ahead and sprinkle some sunflower seeds on your salad, and when you're nibbling mixed nuts in company, don't apologize for monopolizing the Brazil nuts. Broccoli and other herbs contain glutathione. Studies indicate people who are low in the antioxidant compound glutathione are more likely to have arthritis than those who have higher amounts. Vegetables rich in glutathione include asparagus, cabbage, cauliflower, potatoes, tomatoes, and purslane. Fruits with healthy amounts include avocados, grapefruit, oranges, peaches, and watermelon. Rosemary. Rosemary was known in antiquity as the herb of remembrance, which is fitting since rosemary has antioxidants that help prevent aging in cells, and the aging process is certainly associated with memory loss. One Greek-American herb grower tells how her fishing relatives set out to sea with fish dishes heavily covered with rosemary. Even when it was unrefrigerated, this food lasted for days, thanks in part to the antioxidant activity of the rosemary. Can an herb that keeps fish from spoiling help preserve your youth? The jury is still out on that one, but rosemary has preservative powers comparable to the commercial preservatives BHA and BHT. Since we know that antioxidants do help treat arthritis, it makes sense that this antioxidant-rich herb would help thwart this disease. Vitamin C inhibits the progression of osteoarthritis in guinea pigs. Does it work in humans? There's no proof yet that it does, but it certainly cannot hurt to get more vitamin C. Red pepper and many of the other herbs and vegetables mentioned in this chapter contain good amounts. And we'll finish up this afternoon's reading with a more sobering article from the Nature Conservancy. The latest threat to the electricity grid? White supremacists. Neo-Nazi accelerationists hoping to hasten the collapse of society are targeting electrical substations. This article was written by Tristan Corton. Pale and petite, with a penchant for swastikas, drop holsters, and large caliber long arms, Sarah Beth Clendenyall told a colleague in mid-January that she had terminal kidney disease and would probably live for only a few more months. Before the 34-year-old died, she wanted to accomplish something worthwhile, the colleague recounted her saying. Her end-of-life ambition? The one act she believed would leave an indelible mark on the world? Shooting up electrical substations around Baltimore, Maryland. A couple of weeks later, she reiterated this aspiration. If we can pull off what I'm hoping, this would be legendary. For several years now, law enforcement and researchers have been monitoring racially and ethnically motivated violent white supremacist groups and their growing fascination with our country's power grid. Many in these groups are accelerationists, convinced that the best way to achieve their goal of a white supremacist future is to cause society to collapse by plunging it into darkness. The belief is, when the lights go out, people will become violent when they realize the government cannot help them, said Joshua Fisher Birch, a researcher with the County Extremism Project, an international policy organization. It is also a great recruitment tactic. Attacking the electrical grid, he noted, is a topic of growing interest in the neo-Nazi tracts he's reviewed in recent months. White power groups have been focused on grid sabotage since at least 2013, when a group of gunmen shot up 17 transformers at Pacific Gas and Electric Metcalf Electrical Transmission Substation in Coyote, California. The bullets did $15 million in damage, but the grid held. The perpetrators were never found, though, and far-right extremists have been inspired ever since by their clean getaway. When Fisher Birch first began focusing on white supremacists in 2017, there was already chatter about the grid on the websites used by members of the base and the Atomwaffen Division and other hardcore extremists. It is something that is growing, he said. We're seeing more talk as time goes on. This far-right chatter coincides with a recent spike in attacks on electrical grid infrastructure around the country. The Department of Energy's Electric Disturbance Event Summary cataloged 25 physical attacks in 2022, compared with 6 the year before. If you add in vandalism and suspicious activity, there were 162 incidents, the highest level in at least a decade, according to an analysis by Politico. Recent attacks include the December 3, 2022 shooting of two electrical substations in Moore County, North Carolina, which plunged 45,000 people into darkness for days. In the greater scheme of things, 24 physical attacks, or even 100, are mere pinpricks in the country's overall system of 11,000 substations used to move power from electrical generating plants to homes. But experts are taking notice. It's a little early to say if this is going to be a massive trend, said Nicholas Eftimiades, the former chief of counterterrorism operations for the Defense Intelligence Agency and a professor of Homeland Security at Pennsylvania State University. We may be looking at a new form of domestic terrorism that is far more difficult to detect and investigate. Protecting against this threat is equally difficult. There are 56 FBI field offices and over 11,000 substations in this country, FDMEDs said. Do the math. Guarding each of these substations would be inordinately expensive, a cost that would no doubt be passed down to the consumer. That's part of what makes substations appealing targets to saboteurs. Just these few cases are getting a lot of media and press, with minimal risk of loss of life and low risk of getting caught, FDMEDs said. The good news is that the patchwork, non-standardized nature of the U.S. electrical grid makes large-scale outages unlikely. Our systems are diverse, and that makes it difficult for a national attack, Eftimiades said. Most damage is done regionally. We get this stuff knocked out all the time in hurricanes, and if we're not good at anything else, we're good at recovering. The introduction of renewable energy sources, both at the grid level and the individual level, also has helped to diversify the threat field, as Eftimiades put it. The renewable systems incorporated into the grid can be susceptible to cyber attacks, another new threat to the grid, but also provide reserves of power. And homeowners with solar panels and battery storage are generally immune to outside meddling. So while extremists have found a low-risk target, attacking individual substations is unlikely to help them fulfill their dystopian fantasies. For all the power outages extremists have caused, society has yet to collapse. And the episodes are bringing a lot of negative attention to far-right extremism. I could imagine a scenario where these neo-Nazi online accelerationist communities say to themselves, wow, there's a lot of heat. Let's pivot away from this, researcher Fisher Birch noted. So, in the end, Glenn Danielle, who liked to pose for photos in a death's head face mask, combat clothing with Nazi paraphernalia, and an assortment of weapons, was caught before she could do any harm. The colleague she confided in turned out to be an FBI source. In February, the FBI arrested Glenn Danielle and the man who allegedly recruited her, Brandon Clint Russell, the founder of the Adam Waffen Division. Prosecutors charged them in a Maryland federal court with conspiracy to damage an energy facility. They face up to 20 years in prison. And I'd like to thank you for joining us for the June 28th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.